Thanks a lot to the Perimeter Institute for this opportunity to present my work. So this is mostly based on recent work that I've worked in collaboration with Ina Sasevich and Mary Holreno. But I'd like to split up the talk into two distinct halves. I'm sorry, I don't think the images are that readable, but anyway, I'll read them out for you. So I'll divide the talk up into two halves. I'll talk a bit in the first half about the Ice Cube observatory, which is built up to detect neutrinos at the very highest of energies, and some recent results that are forthcoming from the Ice Cube experiment. And in the later half of the talk, I'll focus on some of the inconsistencies that the Ice Cube events are hinting at with respect to standard expectation of astrophysical fluxes from theory, and how, what possible ways one could, what could be possible solutions to addressing these inconsistencies. So in the first half, I'll generally talk about high energy neutrinos and how the Ice Cube expects to detect them. So neutrinos, as you know, are available to us in all sorts of energies, starting from relic neutrinos, which are at the micro EVs, very lowest of energies, relics from the Big Bang origins of the universe, to MeV and to multi-MeV and GeV solar neutrinos, which have been observed, as you know, in the Super Kamiokande. Then supernova bursts also lead to the production of a lot of antineutrinos, which were also observed. These are also typically at span the MeV, GeV energy ranges. Of course, neutrinos are also produced in the Earth from all the reactors, and these are being used of late to pin down several of the neutrino oscillation parameters. So these are also typically around the same energies. And then over a large span of energies, we have neutrinos being produced from cosmic rays interacting with the nuclei in the Earth's atmosphere. So that leads to a large flux of neutrinos spanning a couple of decades of energies, starting from the low MeVs, tens of MeVs, to extending to about the TeV, the largest the largest atmospheric neutrino, largest energy atmospheric neutrino observed till date before the Ice Cube started producing results was about 200 TeVs, I believe. Okay. Above this is the ultra-high energy neutrino spectrum, which is the region of energy that we'll be focused at. This is the energy where neutrinos have only been started, we've just started detecting neutrinos at these energies. The atmospheric neutrinos, of course, there were at least a couple of events that were seen several hundred TeVs, around 200 TeVs. But anything over and above the atmospheric neutrinos, which are expected to come from sources such as active galactic nuclei and gamma ray bursts, which also produce cosmic rays, these have not yet been detected, at least, and these have only recently been detected by the Ice Cube. Until the Ice Cube results, these were completely unseen. Theory predicts neutrino fluxes from such extragalactic sources, but the amount of these neutrinos produced and reaching the Earth is very small compared to what you expect, say, for example, from solar neutrinos. At the very highest end of the spectrum, there are also cosmogenic neutrinos, which are produced when cosmic ray protons interact with relic photons in the universe, producing delta plus resonance and leading to the production of neutrinos at the energies of around hundreds of PeVs and above. So why is the ultra-high energy spectrum, which typically is the name associated with the neutrino spectrum from 100 TeVs and above, why is that interesting? Well, it is interesting because this allows us to probe the highest energy neutrino production mechanisms in the sources such as active galactic nuclei and GRBs, which are expected, which have models in theory, such as, I mean, to explain both proton and neutrino production based on standard model photohedronic interactions. So it'll the amount of neutrinos you observe at the Earth will either confirm or refute the existing models for neutrino production in these sources. In addition, there might be tiny non-standard physical effects which might influence neutrino oscillation as the neutrinos propagate from these very distant sources to the Earth. So if there is something, if there is a mechanism by which heavier neutrinos can decay into the lighter neutrinos, for example, or there are tiny effects of Lorentz symmetry violation, these are things that might be visible at energies this high and not visible at the lower energy. So at these energies provide a nice, these are of relevance to this, to the presence of tiny non-standard physical effects, if indeed they are present.
So what's the momentum transfer for the in the center of mass frame
Sorry?
when say a PeV neutrino interacts with the proton, what's the momentum in this reaction in the center of mass
A PeV neutrino. So these are all lab frame energies.
frame? Right.
Okay, these are energies that you're observing at the Earth. I think PeV neutrinos would have a center of mass energy of around TeVs, yeah, around tens of TeVs, I think, yeah. So, yeah, but these are all lab energies. These are energies that you expect to observe in the Earth, right? So, also neutrinos, because they almost free once produced, they free stream to the Earth almost uninfluenced by any of the objects in the line of sight. These are, of course, chargeless particles with very light masses. These neutrinos, if you have a significant number of neutrinos at these energies, they could be used for pinning down astrophysical point sources in conjunction with gamma ray observations, for example, for active galactic nuclei, GRBs, and so on. Also, of course, it allows you to verify that the neutrino oscillation mechanism extends into these very highest of energies. Additionally, these energies are also ripe recipes for testing dark matter annihilation at the galactic center and for indirect search for very heavy dark matter decay. So, if the dark matter is like several TeVs in energy, you expect dark matter annihilation, for example, to produce standard model particles, which can then produce secondary neutrinos, and these can be observed in the lower end of the ultra high energy spectrum. Similarly, for the indirect, similarly for very heavy dark matter particles around with masses around hundreds of TeVs or a PeV, you can expect the standard model decay products to produce to provide an observable flux of neutrinos and in the ultra high energy region. In addition, of course, there is the possibility that you can test for dark matter products at GEVs. This for WIMP-like dark matter products, for products from WIMP-like dark matter interactions at GEVs and tens of GEVs. That is also something that IceCube is looking at by means of its deep core. So we'll come to that shortly. Our focus in the later half of the talk will be will be related to the indirect search for very heavy dark matter decay. So we'll focus on that in the later half of the talk. So why is it that the ultra high energy neutrinos have escaped detection for so long, while the solar neutrinos and neutrinos, for example, at these energies have all been detected by detectors in the Earth as back as in the 1990s? So there are several issues with the detection. The first of these are the extremely low incident fluxes. As you can see, the fluxes are tiny compared to the fluxes produced from solar neutrinos or even from atmospheric even the atmospheric neutrino flux is well orders of magnitude higher than what you expect of a diffuse astrophysical background from extragalactic sources. So that is of course a big difficulty in detecting these neutrinos because they are so few. The next problem is their huge incident energies, which makes their reconstruction extremely difficult because the charge particles that are expected to be produced from neutrino-nucleon interactions within a detector would have signatures that are very large, and so their energy reconstruction, for example, becomes very difficult. The additional feature that one would like to have is that of flavor discrimination for neutrinos at these energies. And again, that is something that is quite difficult to do given the low fluxes and very high energies. The solution to this, to the detection of ultra high energy neutrinos, were answered by kilometer cube detectors. The answer actually presents itself quite, quite logically, because kilometer cube detectors have at least a 1 kilometer cube volume of material to detect these neutrinos. As a result, they can trap a high fraction of these incident neutrino fluxes. Because of their extremely large volumes, it's possible to properly reconstruct their energies and directions. And they are usually big enough to contain hadronic and electromagnetic cascades that you expect to see out of neutrinos interacting with nucleons at these high energies. In addition, a kilometer cube detector provides the possibility of detecting double bank signatures from incident new taus. That's something also we'll talk about shortly. The first kilometer cube detector that's been operational since 2010 and with full exposure since 2011, December 2011, is called the IceCube. It is located in the South Pole in Antarctica, and it is drilled into the ice bed of Antarctica. So this is what it looks like. These are strings. There are 86 of them, and each string contains about 60 digital optical modules inside them, placed equidistant from each other. So the digital optical modules actually start from this 1460 meters, so from around a depth of 1.4 kilometers. There are no digital optical modules in this region, and this acts as a veto for incoming atmospheric muons and other charged particles. So anything that you observed around here are expected to have a significant chunk of neutrinos alone, all the charged particles being sort of canceled off here. Okay. So this is a comparison of the dimensions of the ice cube against that of the Eiffel Tower, which is, well, tiny compared to this. The depth of the ice cube is around 2.5 kilometers. Yeah, and it is only sensitive from about 1.5 kilometers down. So this is about 1 kilometer in depth, and everything here acts as helps with the background rejection. It is not relevant for neutrino detection as such. Okay, so there are also digital optical modules at the ice top, so that is used to detect gamma rays, for example, that might accompany these neutrinos. So that's how the ice cube looks. There is a small region of the ice cube with much more closely spaced strings, which is called the deep core. Because the strings are much more closely spaced, it is more sensitive to low energy events, so it is capable of looking for dark matter. It is specifically built to look for dark matter, for example, at around tens of GeVs. I mean, products from dark matter annihilation at around tens of GeVs. While all these strings here are widely separated so that the energy threshold, the minimum energy threshold turns out to be around tens of TeVs. So you are not sensitive to, dark matter products below say hundreds of GeVs or so. Right, so this, as I said, has been operational with its full exposure since December 2011. It is capable of distinguishing between the three flavors to a limited extent, as we'll discuss. It does so basically by distinguishing between three kinds of event topologies. Its energy deconstruction capabilities are excellent because of the sensitivity of the digital optical modules and the particular setup of the ice cube. So it's less than 10% for contained cascades and about 30% for tracks, muon tracks produced from nu mu nucleon interaction, charge current interaction within the ice cube detector. The direction reconstruction is also good. It's excellent for tracks. It's not so good for cascades. It's about a degree for tracks and 30 degrees for cascades. The good thing about the ice cube is that it requires minimal operational cost after the construction, so it can run for 10 plus years with very minimal expenditure. It has already collected 28 ultra high energy events above 30 TeVs in 662 days of runtime. Okay, so and that includes two events at PeV plus energies. Both the events were seen at around the PeV, around 1 PeV. So that represents the highest energy neutrino that has ever been seen at any detector on the Earth. It has also recently reported 9 more events. This is as late as in March this year, making the total event number 37 over a span of 988 days. Okay, this is a combined exposure, remember, starting from 2010. The full exposure is only since 2011, but it's been operational since 2010. So there's data taking roughly for 3 years, but not with the full exposure. With the full exposure, there is like about 2 years of data.
So the
among these nine, I'll also discuss this later, but among these nine, there is one which is at around 2.1 PeVs, and I'll show you plots, which is around 2.1 PeVs, but all the rest range from 30 to 350 PeVs. That's the energy range for all the remaining eight. There is just one more event at the PeV. So you have, with the 988 days of exposure, you have like three PeV events, three PeV plus events, and all the rest are like from 30 TeVs to around 300 TeVs. That's what the energy distribution is. So how does the ice cube distinguish between the three flavors? Well, it does so only to a limited extent. So it can distinguish between charge current interactions of the muon neutrino with the nucleus, within the ice. So that produces a muon, which propagates through the body of the detector, scintillating the digital optical modules. So you get what is known as a muon track within the ice cube detector. With very large tracks, you can pin down the direction of the incoming of the incident neutrino very precisely, because of the particular topology of the muon track. This represents a simulation of a muon track. This shows also the timing. This shows that the muon track is propagating downwards, because red indicates earlier times and green indicates later times. So it's a muon which is propagating downward, probably produced as a result of nu mu nucleon charge current interaction. This is likely to be produced outside the ice cube. So you just see the muon propagating through the detector. Ice cube sees cascades from nu e and nu tau nucleon charge current interactions, but these are also produced from all flavor neutrino-nucleon neutral current interactions, which have roughly one third of the cross section of the charge current interactions at these energies. So if you see cascades, they are more likely to be nu e or nu tau charge current interactions rather than neutral current interactions from any of the three flavors. And this is how a cascade looks like. Because of its particular topology, it is not conducive to very good direction reconstruction. But because it's usually contained within the ice cube volume, within the volume of the detector, energy reconstruction for these cascades are usually much better than what they are for muon tracks. In addition, for new taus incident above the PV, you can see a particular signature called the double bang, which is produced, which is really two distinct cascades produced in quick succession, separated by about a track about 50 meters to 100 meters in length. So this is because the initial nu tau nucleon charge current interaction produces a cascade here, which is called the first bang. And the second bang is produced when the tau propagates like about 50 or 50 meters or 100 meters, and then decays in hadronically, preferably hadronically, and produces this other cascade. So this is an event signature particular of the nu tau. It again enables, it again makes the direction reconstruction significantly easier than cascades. Yes, you can. Yeah, there are several. So the probability of a tau decaying into hadrons is, it has a much larger branching ratio into hadrons. So you'll more yes, exactly. So you'll probably observe a double bang in comparison to something that produces a track at this end, for example. So double bangs would be more preferred that way. But of course, you would also see signatures. I think they are called, I think they also have a name. They are called lollipops. So there are lots of funny names associated with the new taus above the 1 PV. Why is this 1 PV and not anything below that? It's just that above 1 PV, the tau travels roughly around 50 to 100 meters, making it possible to distinguish the two cascades. Otherwise, the two cascades are very close together, and it's very difficult to distinguish the signature from this one. So give or take a few TVs, above a PV is when you start to see, you know, very particular signatures of the new tau. So this is something I was already talking about. So the reconstruction of the events at the ice cube depend on which topology it shows in the detector. Muon tracks, for example, are conducive to excellent direction reconstruction. So they are more suited to identifying point objects that lead to the production of the incident neutrinos, which produce these tracks. The energy reconstruction is poorer because the muon produced in the charge current interaction takes away a large chunk of the energy, and the energy of the muon cannot be conclusively known if it travels through the detector and out, okay? Because muons travel several kilometers and often stream out of the detector. So it's very difficult to reconstruct the energy of the muon. And as long as you can't do that, you cannot accurately pin down the energy of the incident nu mu. So the energy reconstruction is done by measuring the energy loss of the muon as it streams across the detector. And so it's rather an indirect method and therefore not that precise. On the other hand, cascades, because they are contained within the detector volume, they can be the energy reconstruction can be done with extremely good precision. However, because of the very spherical nature of the cascades, it's much more difficult to do a proper direction reconstruction. Typically, ice cube is capable of pinning down an incident nu e, for example, to an accuracy of about 35 degrees, which is not that great. For the muon tracks, on the other hand, it's about a degree or two. So it's much more precise. So if you're trying to use neutrinos in the ice cube for identifying point-like objects, muon tracks are the way to go. Yes. Yes, that is. Right? Yeah.
So why cannot be identified as lighter, right? The core must be brighter than the rest.
So yes, they use that to identify the direction of the incident nu e in the cascade. But the reconstruction of the direction using that is, especially in the higher energies where the cascades can be very large, it's not very precise. So they can only tell the angle apart up to 35 degrees. Yeah, for the tracks, it's much easier because often these tracks are about kilometers long. It's very easy to.
Here it's very short.
Yeah, it's very short. I mean, exactly. The cascades range from about 200 meters in radius. So while these tracks can go several kilometers within the detector, it's much easier to do the direction reconstruction and therefore more precise. Although it must be said that even energy reconstruction for the new mu's which interact with the nucleons within the ice cube, within the body of the ice cube, there will also be a cascade and then this track. You'll see both of those. So in such cases, the energy reconstruction for muon tracks is somewhat better compared to if you see only a muon track passing through the ice cube, for example, for a neutrino-nucleon interaction taking place at the periphery of the detector, for example. Right, so what do we expect from, what do we expect from standard theory as to the all-sky, as to the diffuse flux from astrophysical sources? So it's expected that the diffuse flux from the astrophysical sources follow a power law spectrum, largely determined by a shock acceleration of the neutrinos produced at high-energy sources like the GRBs and AGNs. So a Fermi first-order shock acceleration typically predicts an alpha of 2.0 for the neutrino flux proportional to e to the minus alpha. The normalization is fixed by observational best fits. It can also be theoretically predicted, but it has large errors. I mean, it has large even theoretical uncertainties in determining the normalization. So the normalization is usually preferably fixed by observational best fits. So these neutrinos are produced in pion decays from photohedronic interactions like this, where a synchrotron proton interacts with a photon and produces a neutrino and a pi plus. A neutron and a pi plus, the neutron decays, producing the cosmic ray, producing protons that comprise the cosmic ray spectrum that you observe at the Earth. And then this pi plus decays to mu plus and nu mu and so on. So you typically expect 1:2:0 ratio of neutrinos at source, not distinguishing between particles and antiparticles. So standard oscillation, because these are sources at very large distances from the Earth, standard oscillation provides like a averaging effect for these fluxes, and the 1:2:0 flux ratio at the source is reduced to 1:1:1 by the time these neutrinos reach the Earth. So if you expect neutrinos to be produced predominantly from pion decays, from Fermi's first-order shock acceleration, for example, you expect roughly same fluxes for the nu e, nu mu, and nu tau, all proportional to e power minus, roughly proportional to e power minus 2, with some normalization that is fixed by the observation. So that is what you expect from theory. Of course, there are several ways to, there are several models that do this differently. So you can have a preferred power law flux with alpha equal to 2.2. So there are large theoretical uncertainties in all of the standard predictions. There is also the cosmogenic neutrino component, which, as I said, occurs when a cosmic ray proton interacts with a relic microwave background photon. And it produces neutrinos by this mechanism. So delta plus resonantly decays to this pi plus and neutron, which produces a nu e bar, which also contributes to the ultra-high energy neutrino spectrum. In the previous case, there is also a nu e bar produced from the neutron decay, but that is very significantly reduced in energies and doesn't contribute to the ultra-energy spectrum. The only contribution to the neutrino flux in the ultra-energy spectrum comes from the pion decays here and here. But the cosmogenic neutrinos typically have observable fluxes only above the 100 PeVs. So that's not in the energy range that Ice Cube is currently probing yet. but it is expected to study neutrinos beyond beyond the tens of PeVs with much more data accumulated at it over a significantly more runtime. So for now, we won't talk about cosmogenic neutrinos any further. So the recent observations over 662 days includes 28 events. Sorry. So there are like two PeV events which you can see here, and then there is a gap from around 300 TeV to the PeV, and then there are these large number of events from 30 TeVs to the 300 TeV. So the largest is a track that you can see here. So these are the error bars. This is the angle of incidence, and this is the energy deposited in the detector from a cascade, from the observed cascade. So this is a search by the IceCube for all contained cascades, whether they produce a track or not. And seven of these are seen to produce tracks. The rest of them are pure cascades. As you can see, the energy reconstruction of the cascades is much poorer, so longer error bars in this direction, while for tracks, they are very precise. The energy reconstruction is of an almost similar level for tracks and cascades in this particular study, because the study is limited to looking at neutrino events that have, at tracks which have originated within the detector. So having a cascade within the detector helps with the energy reconstruction of these tracks. So two of these are PV plus, as you can see, and the events are roughly distributed across the entire sky. But of course, you expect significant attenuation of neutrinos that are upgoing. The IceCube, remember, is located at the South Pole. So you expect attenuation of neutrinos that travel through the Earth and are seen as upgoing neutrinos in the IceCube. So there is the natural expectation is that there will be more neutrinos that are downgoing rather than upgoing. That is also confirmed by observation.
Usually at smaller energies, you have a difficulty of observing downgoing, right?
Yes, because of the atmospheric background. Exactly, you have difficulties. At 30, I'll show you the comparison with background in the immediately next slide. So at these energies, the atmospheric flux, of course, it's an issue at around the 30 TeVs. But as you go higher and higher, the atmospheric flux becomes much lower. So it stops being an issue at about, say, hundreds of TeVs and above. Okay, so downgoing events are what you expect to see without any, almost clean signals without any interference from atmospheric neutrinos. In fact, above the PeV, the Earth is almost completely opaque to neutrinos. As you know, for solar neutrinos, it can travel through the Earth. Neutrino cross sections are very low, and they can travel through the Earth. But neutrino cross sections are also increasing with energy. By the time they reach the PeV, the Earth becomes opaque to these neutrinos, to all of them almost. So these neutrinos, so the downgoing neutrino flux. The upgoing neutrino flux is expected to deplete strongly above the PeV. So you are, in fact, looking preferably for downgoing neutrinos above the PeV rather than upgoing ones. Okay, and because there is no atmospheric background to contend with, you're fine. Okay, so this shows, again, sorry for the quality of the plot, but I'll read it out to you. So these are the event numbers seen at the IceCube. This is deposited electromagnetic equivalent energy in TeV. So this is 100, this is 1000 on a log scale. This is 10 to the minus 1, 1, 10, and 100, again on a log scale, events over 662 days. Okay, the red color indicates, background muon from the atmosphere. The blue color indicates normal atmospheric neutrino background. The magenta here indicates normal atmospheric background plus 90% neutrino yield from charm decay, which sort of seems to take over at around the TeV from conventional atmospheric neutrinos. Charms are produced and they decay into neutrinos, so they have a different they have a softer spectrum, so which is why they start to become, you know, dominant at around these energies. So they have a spectrum which is e power minus 2.7 rather than the conventional atmospheric neutrinos which fall as e power minus 3.7. So this is 90% confidence level. This is the total atmospheric neutrinos, including 90% confidence level from charm yields. So as you can see, this gray line is the e power minus 2 best fit obtained by the IceCube. There is a complete lack of events at these high energies, from 300 to around 300 PeV to around a PeV. And then there are these two events at the PeV. That's what the IceCube observed. As you can see, this is a log scale. So from around the hundreds, from around the hundreds of TeVs, the atmospheric background starts to fall off, and really everything, almost everything that you see is expected to be from, you know, more energetic sources.
What's the gray line?
The gray line is the e power minus 2 best fit to the data by the IceCube. So as I said, the diffuse astrophysical spectrum is expected to follow a power law, and this is the best fit flux that you get with the data if you assume that it follows a power law which is e power minus 2. Okay. Yes. Well, let me go back to the. So the Ni is around. Well, it's around the PV, okay? So it's around here. That's where the Ni is. You don't see it here, and I don't really have a plot for the cosmic ray flux where it's more apparent that there is a Ni. And then there is an ankle, which is because of the attenuation of cosmic ray protons, because they produce this delta plus resonantly, but that's at much higher energies. That's like around 10 power 10 GeVs or so. So that's the ankle. And then there is the Ni is around the PV. Yeah, so around here would where you'd expect it to be. I don't have a plot for the cosmic ray flux. It's much more apparent there than in the neutrino spectrum here. The neutrino spectrum, you don't yet see it because you have very few events. Yeah, just 28 events. So one expects that if you have as much of flux as you see for the cosmic ray, if you have enough statistics, you'll start to see the effects of the Ni here as well. This one, 90% with 90% confidence level.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, with 95%, they don't make an estimate, but we did this calculation. I don't remember, but it's closer to 3.2 or 3.1 sigma. I don't remember the exact, but it's still pretty significant given that these are only 28 events. Okay, 28 events at these energies, you expect an yield of around 6 to 7 atmospheric neutrinos at these energies. So this is still a very, you know, clear signal that there is something with, there is a yield of neutrinos which is above the atmospheric neutrino yield, okay? And of course, certainly if you only take these PeV events, the atmospheric flux has almost no way of contributing there. So these are definitely from sources that are, you know, much more energetic and probably extragalactic. So the best fit is largely consistent with an e power minus 2 power law flux up to the 1.1 PV where they observe these two events. So the e square phi is 1.2 plus or minus 0.4 into 10 power minus 8 GeV per centimeter square per second per steradian. But observe that above the 1 PV, there are no events at all. So if this power law flux is expected, if the power law flux doesn't have an abrupt cutoff above the PeV, then it's still expected to yield about 4 events from, say, 2 PeVs to around 10 PeVs, which the IceCube doesn't observe. The IceCube has searched, is sensitive to these energies, but it's, the IceCube hasn't seen any event yet from 2 to 10 PeVs. This is considering the 662 days of data, so not the 998 days recent update in March, okay? So although it is, in fact, you know, it at least largely confirms theoretical expectation of standard photohedronic neutrino production in the high energy sources like AGNs, there are several issues that crop up even though statistics are low and you really need a large number of events to make definitive claims. But there are some noteworthy inconsistencies with the theoretical prediction. The first is, of course, the unexplained sharp drop of events above the PEV. A power law flux is expected to yield events 4 to 10 events from 4 to 6 events from 2 to 10 PEVs, and you don't see them. So there looks to be a very sharp drop above the PEV, and then there is this rather mysterious lack of events within the 300 TVs to one PEV. From power law flux, e power minus 2 best fit, as you can see, you expect a sizable number of events at both these bins. So at least an event here and a couple of events here. So you don't see any. Not only that, as I'll show you, later, most of the work that we have done is based on the 662 days of data. But even with the 998 days of data, which is more updated, you'll see that this sort of gap still remains in the event spectrum. Okay, and that's kind of odd, because for the power law spectrum, you expect rather a smooth distribution of events across all these energies. Okay, in addition, there are the sub 100 TeV energies where the event rates predicted by the e power minus 2 flux along with the predicted atmospheric background undercounts the is less compared to the number of events that are seen, so consistently less, if I might say, because the e power minus 2 flux predicts much less events here, here as well as here. So this gray line is somewhere around here and is around here for this one. So while in the lower energies, it sort of undercounts, predicts a lower yield of neutrinos, at the higher energies, it somehow predicts a higher yield of neutrinos. So there are some inconsistencies with what is expected from a standard astrophysical power law flux. It might well be that these are statistical fluctuations, but nonetheless, one needs to think of what might be that could cause these inconsistencies if they were to persist with more data. So we looked at this and thought that there might be an additional component to the neutrino flux over and above the astrophysical signal. Okay, so the astrophysical signal is the power law flux, which is this gray line represented in this plot. And we think that there is an additional flux of neutrinos at energies 10 to 100 TeVs, which makes up for the undercounting of neutrinos predicted by the power law flux, e power minus 2 flux here.
The astrophysics neutrino flux, the overall normalization is not well predicted.
Is not well predicted. So yeah, so you can, exactly. Right. That's correct, yes. And the best fit here is like 1.2 into 10 power minus 8. And that is what is somewhat inconsistent with these event rates.
So
yes.
In principle, everything could come from a new source.
Exactly, it could. And I'll also talk about some recent work that has been done along the lines that you're suggesting. In principle, everything could come from a different source. I mean, but at least with the 998, days of data, it starts to look like there might be a power law flux. So we'll see. So a few things that this allows us to do is it allows us to modify the normalization to the diffuse astrophysical flux fixed by PEV events. Okay, so it allows the PEV events. So this is empty because you have to determine the normalization by allowing the normalization to vary and doing a best fit after adding this additional flux of neutrinos. So we'll look at what that normalization is in a short while. So you expect the normalization, if you add an additional component of neutrinos here, you can sort of push this normalization down so that it becomes more consistent with these high energy events without being inconsistent with this one here. Okay. So a lower normalization would allow for better match with the lack of events in the high energy sort of well, where you don't see events from 300 TeV to 1 PeV. And this lower energy events would then be accounted for by the sum total of the neutrino flux from the additional source and the astrophysical background now. Okay. So what could be the possible sources at these energies? We know for sure that they can't all be atmospheric, because the atmospheric neutrino flux is well predicted, and it would require more than 4.5 times of the atmospheric flux to account for these neutrinos here. These are not from the cosmogenic sources, because these are too low in energy for cosmogenic sources. So these sources are definitely ruled out.
So I have a specific question. What,
yes.
What sets the lower energy cutoff for the cosmogenic? You said it's around 100 PeV.
Yeah.
The
scale is set by the energies. I mean, this delta plus is resonantly produced, and then it decays. So the scale is set by the resonance of this delta plus, and the lowest energy neutrinos that you observe from cosmogenic sources actually come from this neutron decay, and they populate around the hundreds of PeVs. These neutrinos, which are in a 1:2:0, typically come about several PeVs higher. Several orders of magnitude higher. So it's set by the delta plus resonance and then the neutrino decay energies. So two exotic sources could be possibly the annihilation products of heavy dark matter of weighing around 100 PeVs in mass. So its annihilation could yield standard model particles, which could then interact and produce neutrinos, observable neutrino flux to be seen at the ice cube. So that would have a predominantly large signal from the galactic center, as you'd expect of dark matter annihilation. And in fact, the ice cube events do see a slight excess towards the galactic center. Remember, these are very low number of events, so the statistical significance is tiny, but there is a very small excess towards the galactic center. So that's good news. But the bad news is that for WIMP-like cross sections, for thermalized dark matter, the expected ice cube signal for dark matter annihilation products is too low. So you really can't do a good indirect search of heavy dark matter products without waiting for like 50 years. Okay. Yes, it could. That is possible. Yes, that is possible. This is for a very standard prediction for dark matter annihilation to standard model particles. So we considered instead the possibility that heavy dark matter could decay and decay to standard model particles like Z pairs or W pairs or tau plus tau minus and so on. The good part about dark matter decay is that they have the same order of magnitude contribution from galactic and extragalactic sources, and they give a diffuse flux that is largely from the entire sky, so that's like more consistent with what Ice Cube is observing. Ice Cube observes events both downgoing and upgoing with more or less expected numbers. So the Ice Cube so the observable event rates predicted are comparable to what you expect from neutrino fluxes given by the ice cube best fit. So you expect like two events at the PV for very reasonable lifetimes for this dark matter. If you have a 2 PV dark matter, you could, if it decays to neutrinos, you could see 1 PV monochromatic dark matter, which is what the ice cube sees, with very reasonable lifetimes in the sense like 10 to the 27, order of magnitude 10 to the 27 seconds. That's to explain the relic abundance of the dark matter and make sure that it makes up for 27% of the universe's energy budget. Okay, so dark matter in principle could have very exotic decay channels, but for simplicity, we'll limit ourselves to very specific decays of the dark matter. So we'll assume, first of all, that it's a single dark matter species, so not a multi-component dark matter sector, but a single dark matter species, which decays with lifetimes of the order of 10 power 27 seconds. We limit to the study of scalar dark matter, We limit the decays to two-body decays, and with each of them with a single decay channel. We study four specific decay channels in this case. We do not study decays to nu-nu bar because they produce a strongly peaked feature around the MDM, around half the mass of the dark matter. We don't need that. We don't need that strongly peaked nature because we want to explain the sort of the continuum of events at the low energies. If you have a very strongly resonant feature, you might be able to explain the disparity in events in one of these bins, but we want to explain like a continuum of events at these energies. People have. Yes. People have. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that, but that fit, I mean, the flux from that calculation is somewhat in tension with the low energy, with the low energy events. Okay,
is it under-predicting?
It's under predicting the low energy events, and it's in more of a tension than with the low energy events than the ice cube best fit is. So while it provides a very convenient explanation for the lack of events here, because there's a peak and then there's a drop and then there's a continuum, there is some problems explaining events at these energies. Okay, so that has been done. Actually, I also have the reference for that, I think, somewhere. Yeah, so that's the here. I mean, it's in somewhere around July 2013 or something like that. So they considered no astrophysical neutrinos, okay, only dark matter decay. And that dark matter decay was to this specific channel, nu-nu-e bar with a branching ratio of 12%. And QQ bar with a branching ratio of 88%. So this QQ bar yields secondary neutrinos, which makes up the continuum, low energy continuum of events. And the monochromatic PV neutrinos, which are almost monochromatic, both of them roughly around the one PV, come from this decay to the primary neutrino. So that has been done. This also explains, you know, as I said, conveniently, it explains the lack of events in these energies. But they are in some tension with low energy events. So there are problems because of the shape, exactly, because of the shape of the flux that you get from the QQ bar production, I mean secondary neutrino fluxes. I don't remember, I'm sorry. This is the reference, I think I'll have to look that up once more. Yeah. Right, so this is what our procedure is. So we don't take into account nu-nu bar, we don't take into account QQ bar as well, because we are looking, we'll look at dark matter particles which are about hundreds of TeVs, and the neutrino from QQ bar starts to dominate about three orders of magnitudes below that. Okay, so if the neutrino, so you typically not have neutrinos around the tens of TeVs from a QQ bar interaction if the dark matter is of a 100 TeVs in mass. Okay, so these are the two channels that we omit from our calculation, and consider these four instead. Okay, so to evaluate the neutrino spectrum per decay, we use Pythia. Okay, but we needn't have, because there is this very nice recipe which already gives neutrino fluxes, secondary and primary neutrino fluxes from dark matter yields. But nonetheless, because we wish to also study very exotic decay channels in the future, we have set up our Pythia simulation to evaluate the neutrino spectrum per decay. And we compared our results to the results from PPC. This is where you can get the PPC code. Well, for free. So we compared our fluxes our spectrum with the spectrum here, and they were almost identical. So that provides us some satisfaction that we are doing the right thing with Pythia. I'm a very novice Pythia user, so this was like of some confidence for me. In addition, after these are produced at the sources, the tri-bimaximal mixing, which is what we resort to amongst the neutrino flavors, make sure that these neutrino flavors, the flavors are averaged out largely to 1:1:1. But in the case of the leptonic channels, there could be prevalent, I mean, one of the flavors could be more prevalent than the others. We actually incorporate tri-bimaximal mixing into our code to correctly predict the flux ratios that you'll be observing at the Earth, no matter what the initial flux ratios of the neutrinos were at source. Okay, so these are the spectrum number of neutrinos produced per dark matter decay, and these are actually taken from the PPPC website. They have the data table, so you can easily do these plots. So this green line represents a decay channel of dark matter to E plus E minus. It's something that we don't consider. This to mu plus mu minus, then to tau plus tau minus, and so on. So it's all represented here. So we are looking at green dotted lines, so around here, and tau plus green dashed lines and dotted lines, so which are here, and to W and C, which are the blue lines here. Okay. So the other channels are turned off in our analysis. So the total flux of neutrinos that you expect to see from dark matter decay includes both galactic and extragalactic fluxes. So with the galactic, the contribution of neutrinos from the galactic flux is given by this integral. In essence, this is an integral over the line of sight, and over we use an NFW distribution of the dark matter density. So essentially, this just becomes, for a given MDM and a given lifetime, this essentially becomes just a constant factor times the dNdE. The other is the extragalactic component, where, of course, because these come from very distant sources, you have to account for redshift in their energies and the expansion rate of the universe. This is given by square root of 1 plus z whole cube plus the 1 plus z whole cube omega m plus omega lambda. That's what this is. So again, this is an integral that you need to do after properly calculating the d and d nu, which we did in the previous slide. So the total flux that you see is a combination of this and this, and then the astrophysical, I mean, then the neutrino oscillation that goes into propagation of these sources. The good thing, as I said, about neutrino decay is that you obtain comparable contributions from galactic and extragalactic fluxes, same order of magnitude. So the flux is really diffuse, obtained from almost the whole of the entire sky. And so because high energy neutrinos are attenuated by Earth, which is something I was talking about, you expect more downgoing neutrinos than upgoing neutrinos naturally. So our results, I'll enlarge this plot in a while. So our results will show that the hidden component, as we call it, of neutrinos from dark matter decay are contribute to the neutrino flux at Earth in addition to the astrophysical power law flux. Okay, and we show that dark matter of mass of the order of 100 TeVs could decay to Standard Model particles, which then produce secondary neutrinos, which contribute to neutrino yields at 30 to 100 TeVs, and account for the undercounting of the neutrinos by the ice cube power law flux. So the dark matter decay augments the low energy event rates, and also we see that if you allow the normalization of the astrophysical flux to vary, you can settle for a reduced power law flux normalization, which becomes consistent with the lack of events at this 300 TeVs to 1 PeV, while still being consistent with the low energy events, because most of these low energy events are now coming from the dark matter decay. Okay, so this is probably clearer. Two events at the PV can be still explained by a reduced normalization, as I'll show you, within the error bounds. So this is for each of the channels. So this is dark matter to the Z boson pair. This is dark matter to W plus minus. This is dark matter to tau plus minus and mu plus minus in that order. The green dotted line here represents the ice cube best fit. Okay, so this is why we say that the ice cube best fit is somewhat of a tension with the events here and here, also slightly here, but it's within the error bars, of course. But the ice cube events are also in tension with the lack of events at these energies. Okay, so that's the ice cube best fit. Then we have two results from our study, where in one case we fix the astrophysical normalization to the ice cube best fit and then add a dark, low energy dark matter component to it. So that's this magenta line, okay? And that shows, of course, at the higher energies where the dark matter contributes nothing, where the entire contribution of neutrinos comes from the astrophysical flux, you have results, events numbers that are identical to the ice cube. So these are also inconsistent with the lack of events in the well. But in the lower energies, they start to become more consistent. And specifically for this and this, these energy bins, the dark matter plus astrophysical normalization at the ice cube best fit accounts for these low energy events better, okay, in all of these four cases. Then we do the analysis where we allow the astrophysical flux normalization to vary as well. And we see that reduced astrophysical flux normalization, which is roughly at half the ice cube best fit, also allows for consistency with the high energy events, and with increased neutrino yields from dark matter decay becomes consistent with events at the low energies as well. So with the astrophysical flux normalization varying and dark matter mass and lifetime varying, we do best fits to determine what is the best fit nature of our plots. We see that we get chi-squares, which are significantly reduced compared to the ice cube best fit, which is at around 10.7. This represents that our data, the predictions from our analysis matches the event rates better. But of course, one has to, you know, properly account for the fact that we are also using two additional parameters to do the best fit, which means that we should do a more rigorous quantitative measure of how much more significant our fits are compared to the IC best fit. And we do a statistical F test to determine the significance of our best fits. And the results are shown here for each of the channels. The p values that the ice cube best fit, the p values that the ice cube best fit is not better than, I mean, our best fits are more significant than the ice cube best fits are given by these numbers. So 0.061. Anything below 0.05, we would consider to be a pretty strong rejection of the ice cube best fit in favor of the best fit obtained by our analysis here. So with the given statistics that we have, we are already sort of skimming that value.
And why
are
the events for what?
These are events over 662 days. Yeah, so these are event numbers.
Why does the data go below one?
The error bars, you mean, or? The points go below one because you've seen zero events in some of the bins. You have seen no events at all in some of the bins. And you've seen like seven and events sort of here. So that's what it represents. Right, so we also carried out the analysis to see if both dark matter and the astrophysical flux were to be present simultaneously yielding the neutrino flux that we observe at Earth. Then what are the preferred regions? What are the preferred regions for the dark matter parameter space in terms of the mass and the lifetime? So this is log tau dm over 10 to the 27 seconds, and this is mdm in PEVs ranging from 0.1, ranging from 0.1 to about 1 PEV. Okay, so this shows that this is the 3 sigma allowed region. This is the analysis where we kept the astrophysical flux at the ice cube best fit. So obviously, if you have a dark matter which is very heavy, It would also contribute, in addition to the event rates already coming from the astrophysical flux, it would contribute event rates here. So it would pull up these event numbers even more and become more inconsistent with what is observed. So you naturally have a stronger rejection of the parameter space at higher and higher dark matter mass. And the 3 sigma allowed region is shown in green here for each of the 4 channels. Okay, this is ZZ, this is W plus W minus, this is mu plus mu minus, and tau plus tau minus. Okay, and when we allow the astrophysical flux normalization to vary as well, that opens up the parameter space significantly. So entire green region becomes accessible to within 3 sigma. The pink shade, the pink hatched and shaded regions represent 90% and 99% excluded regions if the neutrino flux is coming from both both astrophysical flux as well as the dark matter decay. Okay, so this represents the constraints on our dark matter parameter space, and it's not a surprise therefore that the best fit MDM that we obtain lies close to the 200 TeVs. So the conclusions for the dark matter plus astro analysis is that, of course, the most important conclusion is that you require more data. You know, 28 events are too few to do any kind of reasonable statistics with. But within the purview of limited statistics, reduced astrophysical flux and plus low energy neutrinos from dark matter decay fits the observed data significantly better than the ice cube best fit, which is done assuming a power law to physical flux alone. Okay, this allowing the astrophysical flux normalization to vary brings about consistency with lack of events in the 300 TeV to 1 PeV energies. In addition, it also provides a better match to the sub 100 TeV events, which are accounted for mostly by decay neutrinos produced as decay products from the dark matter interaction. And the event spectrum, as you have seen, favors 100 TeV scale dark matter, and is very strongly constraining, in fact, for PeV scale dark matter, which is at least in this case excluded at 90% confidence level completely. So this is, of course, with astrophysical flux fixed at the ice cube best fit. If you allow the flux normalization to vary, a significant region of the parameter space actually opens up compared to here. So as I have already talked about, I mean, this is the other interesting effort that was done to address similar issues seen with the ice cube 28 events. Okay, and this is a very notable effort as well. It's only that in the lower energy events, it has some tension. It has somewhat of more of a tension than the ice cube best fit does. So that's kind of one of the like blotches on this model. Otherwise, it's a very novel effort to explain very naturally the lack of events in the 300 TeV to 1 PeV and the 2 monochromatic events. So the other thing is also that background estimates for neutrino fluxes from charm decay in the low TeV energies, which are 30 TeVs to around 100 TeVs, those need to be updated because the present calculations which were done way back in 2008 were based on very outdated PDFs, and it might well be that a better knowledge of the background here from charm decays might already account for the neutrino fluxes, disparity between the neutrino fluxes from theory and experiment from astrophysical fluxes alone. So this is something that needs to be done as well. It's important for the low energy spectrum. In conclusion, this very recent update from IceCube, March, so the 662 days results were presented in November 2013 in a paper, but there have been 9 more events since December 2013, so since then, so making it 37 in total. One event is at 370 TeV, and there are still no events from 400 TeVs to 1 PeV, so it seems like the well has sort of shrunk a little, but a lack of events in the 600 across 600 TeVs of energy is still something that is significant. There is one more PV plus event, which is at around 2.1 PeVs. So we have a total of 3 PV plus events, and the e power minus 2 best fit now sits at around 0.95 into 10 to the minus 8, compared to. Well, this one is a little further off. The energy reconstruction is very precise at the PV energies because all three events, all three of these events are cascades, and this is not consistent with a monochromatic source. The two events reported in the 662 run data were actually consistent with a monochromatic source, but this is somewhat further off. So this, with the updated data, it's probably more difficult to explain it with a peaked nature coming from dark matter decay. Sure. Okay, so in all, the ice cube is doing reasonably well. It should be operational for the next 5 to 10 years at least. And so we expect to observe, you know, enough events to do good statistics with. The event rates at present are still too low. But if some of these features, like the lack of events in the high energy well, persist, they would call for, you know, they would call for more exotic explanations than an astrophysical power law flux can provide. And it will be interesting to keep looking at what the ice cube results tell us over the next, at least over the next couple of years or so. So thank you. In our case, so the yes, from for the incident direction, see again very few events, but the ice cube is more or less consistent with a diffuse flux that is roughly equal from entire sky.
Okay.
Yes, basically isotropic. So dark matter decay, which we consider again because the extragalactic and the galactic contributions are roughly equal in magnitude, you expect a diffuse flux which is largely isotropic as well.
So
there is some preference towards the galactic center, which is interesting because there is a very small statistical center, I mean statistical hint that there is a clustering at the dark, at the galactic center. I should probably show you some other plot. I don't have them in. Let me see if I have the probabilities for that. Not really, but I can send you the plot later. There is the slightest statistical hint that there is a clustering, at least with the 998 events, there is some sort of a clustering at the galactic center. But it's not strong enough to hint at something like dark matter annihilation, where you expect much more.
Well, also from a statistics, I would expect that.
Yeah.
If it's a galactic source,
then
I would expect.
Yeah, yeah. Anything that is predominantly galactic would give you. A strong clustering at the galactic center. But the hints are that it's mostly isotropic with a very small, you know, excess at the galactic center. We can, I think over the next year or so with more data, this should be clarified, this should become clarified. Remember also that direction reconstruction is not that good. Most events that you see are cascades. So you can only reconstruct the direction to about 30-35 degrees.
Yeah.
Which is not that great. But if you were to start observing a large number of tracks, then it would be, then using the track sampling alone, you'd be able to properly determine, because the direction reconstruction is much better there, you'd be able to properly determine if the galactic center excess is indeed statistically relevant. At present, out of these 28 events, there are just seven which are tracks, and maybe a couple of them are from atmospheric. So very low number of track events to do any proper direction based statistics yet.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.